I'm Nancy Solomon from the WNYC Newsroom in for Tanzina Vega all week. This is The Takeaway. In recent weeks, we've seen a number of springtime surges of COVID-19 in states across the U.S., from my home base of New Jersey all the way to Oregon. But unlike with other surges, there's been a key difference. As states have prioritized vaccinating those 65 and older, there's been a dramatic decrease in the number of hospitalizations among that population. And at the same time, we're now seeing more and more younger people, those in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, hospitalized, many of whom only became eligible for vaccines recently. In Michigan, one of the country's current hotspots, hospitals are admitting more young people than at any other point in the pandemic, twice the rate they saw last fall, according to the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. And though new infections and even hospitalizations are starting to slow in Michigan and elsewhere, what do these recent spring surges tell us about the trajectory of the pandemic in the U.S.? Let's talk about it. We're joined now by Apoorva Mondavilli, science reporter for The New York Times. Apoorva, always good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure to be here.
And we also have Emily Martin, associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And let's start with you, Emily. You know, we have a lot to get through, but let's start with Michigan. It looks like things are getting a little better, but what explains that recent surge that you had in COVID cases there?
Yeah, well, things are definitely looking like they are slowing down and maybe even beginning to decline. But what we've really seen is a combination of more movement and activity around the state, and then, the consequences of having to deal with this more transmissible variant that we have widespread across the state. You know, as we look at the data on travel and activity in our spaces, we're seeing that people are moving around the communities as much as they were even before the pandemic. And so, you know, we really see that show up in our numbers.
And is any of this stemming from the hospitals lowering standards for hospital admissions? Is that part of the cause, too, that people who maybe weren't as sick are being allowed to go to the hospital?
This could be part of it. You know, anytime we have to remember that we've seen infection rates in the youngest, you know, 0 to 9 year olds, 10 to 19 year olds, higher than they've been at any time before in the pandemic. And so anytime you have a big surge in a group that you haven't seen a lot of transmission in before, you're going to see more hospitalizations in that group. The same is true. You were seeing a lot of, you know, younger adults and then even, you know, 50 to 59 year olds in the hospital still as well. And so part of it is just because case rates have been so high in that group over the last couple of weeks. Part of it is, you know, the hospitals aren't sort of at surge capacity taking care of 70 to 79 year olds, 80 to 89 year olds, because really we're seeing incredibly low rates in those groups. And so you're right that what sometimes will happen is, you know, where hospitals may have asked for someone to spend a little bit more time caring at home before coming in, now they're more likely to admit them. And so that would extend to these younger age groups.
Well, that's going to really help with the outcomes, I would imagine, if, you know, the benchmark for getting into the hospital is a little easier. Apoorva, is Michigan the exception or the norm? How are things going on around the rest of the country?
Michigan may be the more extreme version of something that's going on in a lot of different states. So we know that this variant, B.1.1.7, has been on the rise in quite a bit of the country. It may be that it just showed up early and really increased in Michigan. Michigan has one of the highest proportions of B.1.1.7 among its cases, but other states are starting to catch up. We don't know whether we'll see surges there the same way that we have in Michigan, just because it's just so complicated right now, because the vaccination numbers are going up and, you know, the restrictions are very different in every single state. And B.1.1.7 started growing in different states at different times. So it's incredibly hard to predict exactly what we'll see, but it's possible that we'll see some peaks in at least some of these states. I mean, we're seeing that Oregon, for example, is seeing a really high rate of case growth. Puerto Rico is seeing an increase. And a bunch of southern states, Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, North Carolina, and Arkansas, they're all starting to see their numbers pick up. So we may start to see some increases there, too.
And in those other places that you mentioned, is the new variant driving those surges, or are there other factors as well?
The new variant is driving a bit of the cases in almost every place. It's about half of the total cases in almost every state. And over time, that will keep rising. So what we've been seeing is that the original form of the virus that, you know, started last year has been going down, and B.1.1.7 has been going up. It's a little bit hard to say exactly what the proportions are because we just don't do enough surveillance as a country to know that. But it looks like about half right now of B.1.1.7 cases, and that will keep going up.
Emily, early in the pandemic, we know that certain populations, especially communities of color, were being disproportionately impacted. Is that still the case in Michigan?
So we definitely see those disparities where, I think we're most concerned, which is hospitalizations. We definitely see severe disease impacting communities of color more strongly than we would like, for sure. And so, you know, with that kind of comes a responsibility to try to make sure that we're getting vaccination widely accessible to all communities, because I don't think that that's going to go away. You know, even if we see shifts in the age demographic, even if we see shifts in the general trajectory of the pandemic, we're still going to be concerned about this disproportionate severity.
Right. And Apoorva, in states led by Republicans and Democrats, like Texas on the Republican side, Connecticut on the Democratic side, we've seen a rollback of pandemic-related restrictions. What do we know about how that's affecting case counts in those states?
You picked two very different examples, so this actually gives us a little bit of insight into what works or maybe doesn't work. Connecticut's numbers are on the downswing. They're about 25% down from 14 days ago, and hospitalizations are also down. But the rollback of restrictions in Connecticut has been different than in Texas. Bars are closed, for example, and masks are mandatory, and they have a curfew. And Connecticut also has one of the highest numbers of people vaccinated. About half of the population in Connecticut has had at least one dose, and 36% have been fully vaccinated. Texas is a little bit different. Texas, we're seeing a small decrease in cases, but hospitalizations are steady, and their vaccination numbers are a little bit lower. They've only seen about a third of their population has had at least one dose. And some counties within Texas are showing big increases. So, you know, we also know that southern states show a spike later in the summer. So I wouldn't quite conclude yet that Texas is out of the woods. I think a lot will depend on the next few weeks.
I think it was probably predicted. I think there was quite a lot of talk just as the vaccines were, being rolled out, that we were going to encounter problems with messaging around public health messaging around those who have been vaccinated versus those who have not. Apoorva, how is that playing out in these states where we're seeing surges? Are we giving double messages, and is that causing problems?
I think it is causing some problems. As you know, we were trying to see messages from the CDC, for example, saying that people who are vaccinated can get together with another unvaccinated family. But then there was some confusion around, do they still need to wear masks everywhere else? And there was some pushback against that in some of the states, especially states led by Republican governors who didn't want mask mandates. So it's been very variable. I mean, there are some people who are, you know, seeing grandparents, seeing grandkids, seeing friends hugging each other, which is just glorious. but, you know, some people are partying even when they're not vaccinated. And some people who are fully vaccinated are having trouble transitioning back to normal and are still afraid. And that may just take a little bit more time. So it's sort of all over the place at the moment. And hopefully, as people start to see that these vaccines really work, we'll start to even those out a little bit.
And Emily, what are you seeing in Michigan in terms of the vaccination rate and how that's impacting this recent surge?
Yeah, well, I think, the vaccine rate in Michigan, so we're over 30% as a state, but I think that the rates in the older adults are really exciting. So we've got over 70% in our 70 and older have been at least started vaccination, and we've seen an incredible impact on case rates and on hospitalizations in that group. And then, you know, we're seeing the other groups, the younger groups, starting to pick up as well. But, you know, it's like was mentioned, it's so complicated because now you've got all of this excitement about the vaccine being available, even when we don't have a lot of uptake in the youngest age groups yet. When really, those are the groups that are out and moving around. And so we're almost seeing the activity pick up in the people that are not vaccinated, even though they haven't totally caught up with the getting both doses and waiting the 14 days. And so I think that that's kind of contributing to all of this excitement and activity moving around the spaces, even though coverage isn't really there yet.
And what kind of hesitancy are you seeing in Michigan? And I'm wondering if the good results that are being seen with the older population is having an impact on middle-aged and younger people who might have initially been hesitant wanting to get a vaccine now.
Yeah, I've definitely anecdotally heard about, you know, the big mass vaccination, kind of the era of mass vaccination that we just went through is starting to slow down for sure, that you're not getting full schedules at these big kind of locations that you really need to take a day off of work and drive to and do a lot to get there. And what we're starting to see is vaccine supply start to catch up and maybe even outpace demand around the state. And so, you know, some of this is going to be, you know, communities where vaccine confidence is not as high. And some of this is going to be, you know, we're going to have to switch from this mode of mass delivery of vaccination to really bringing vaccines to people where they are and where they'll get it if it's convenient and if it's right there and not have to take a day off to go get the vaccine. And so we're moving to a different challenge. And I think you're going to have to, you see a lot of public health groups have to adapt their strategy.
And Apoorva, are you seeing changes in terms of how younger people might be responding to getting a vaccine because of between the surge in younger people and older folks doing better?
The vaccine has been available to anybody over 16, and in some places there is quite a bit of demand from younger people. But overall, as Emily mentioned, we have really seen older people get vaccinated. I mean, nationwide, about 82% of seniors are vaccinated. So that's great, because those are the people that are at the highest risk. But we do need more younger people to get vaccinated, because they're the ones who are out and about and spreading the virus. So if we want to see the case numbers go up, they need to get vaccinated.
Right. Emily, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is now available again after the distribution was temporarily paused to study the link with a rare blood clotting disorder. What's the latest on that? How do you think people will perceive this specific vaccine moving forward?
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to watch the impacts on vaccine confidence going forward and how it affects vaccine rates. You know, I am glad that people have the opportunity to be informed and to make the choice whether or not to receive it now. I really view the pause as the system working as it's supposed to work. And, you know, what the CDC and the FDA did as we moved into these vaccines having emergency use approval was, you know, they said to the American public, we're going to monitor things and we're going to stop and we're going to review it if we see anything that's concerning. And they did, and they did it in a really transparent way. And so I think to not have done that would have really brought up a lot of concerns with confidence and trust. And so I think, you know, I'm glad that the system worked the way that it did. And we'll have to see what the impacts are going forward and whether that impacts people's decisions. You know, for some people, the benefit of having one dose, and especially people that, you know, don't like needles or have other sort of restrictions that would make having a two-dose series hard, you know, having that choice is going to be good for them. But we're going to have to kind of push availability and information and see what that leads to. I think we're lucky that we've got such ample supply of all three products in the U.S. now. And so if somebody, you know, is uncomfortable getting the J&J vaccine, then there's going to be hopefully enough ready supply to get something else.
And Apoorva, are you seeing any kind of impacts on the hesitancy to take the vaccine from the J&J issue? Has it done anything to move the needle one way or the other in terms of how people are feeling about getting the vaccine?
Unfortunately, it's made hesitancy worse across the board, not just for J&J, but even for the other vaccines. that may be just a timing issue. This just happened and people may need time to adjust. But yeah, it does look like it's had a bad impact. But, you know, as Emily said, this was the process working as it should. So I'm not sure what they could have done differently other than, you know, keep this hidden. And I think that would have had problems of its own. So in order to sort of figure out that it's women of childbearing age who are most at risk and that, you know, doctors may need to treat cases that come in with blood clots a little bit differently, I think they had to do this. So people are just going to have to work extremely hard to resolve some of that hesitancy. I mean, there's, you know, hesitancy comes in all different forms. It's lack of access, access to bad information, misinformation, disinformation, and people just not really trusting the system. So every kind of hesitancy is going to need a slightly different strategy.
I mean, it's kind of interesting that, you know, math and science literacy was not a strong suit for the United States pre-pandemic. And now we're being asked to understand these very complicated concepts of, in terms of just statistically what that, you know, the blood clot issue represents in terms of the numbers. So it just seems that it's a hard road to sow for public health officials to get people on board understanding, you know, risk. We don't do a very good job of understanding risk, right?
Yeah, we really don't. I mean, people overestimate risk all the time and people underestimate risk all the time. But this is one of those cases where the system is the way it is for a good reason. And I think partly people do have to trust that the FDA and the CDC know what they're doing. We've seen a lot of armchair expertise during this pandemic. A lot of people backseat driving and second guessing what the FDA is doing and how long it takes to do things. And I think people really have to trust in the process and know that this is the way it is because they are looking out for public health. But it does create a lot of challenges for those people in the field who are trying to convince people to take a vaccine.
Emily, where are we in terms of children being vaccinated? Have any of the COVID vaccines been approved yet for people under 16?
Not yet. And as you know, I have a 12-year-old, and so I'm like watching this very closely. You know, there has been information provided to the FDA to extend one of the vaccines down to 12. There are ongoing trials for younger age groups as well. But no data has come out yet in terms of being, you know, really hard data that can be reviewed to extend those down. And so we're really probably looking out to towards the end of the year for the youngest age groups, for the elementary school age groups to be able to get them vaccinated. So we're going to be in this, you know, as complex as it is now, we're going to be in this middle period as we sort of get as many adults as we can vaccinated. And we still have a ton of cases in our youngest age groups that have no vaccine option.
And Apoorva, what do you think about getting children vaccinated? I mean, in terms of stopping the spread of the virus, how critical do you think that is?
We don't really have a good sense of how well kids spread the virus because they've been masked and they've been in schools. And we think most likely they don't spread the virus very much, but it's not zero. So they do contribute some to the spread of the virus overall in a community. And pretty much every expert I've spoken with has said we're not going to be able to get to herd immunity without vaccinating kids because they are such a big proportion of the population. People under 18 are about 20 to 23% of the population.
And Emily, we'll give you the last word. Quickly, give us a sense of what people need to know about how to stay safe right now.
You know, it's too early to be all holds barred with the virus and to just go like we're all vaccinated. And so I think we're going to walk this middle ground for a while, keep being, you know, keep doing what works to stay safe, masks, social distancing, while we use vaccination to be able to do some of these things, you know, even safer. And we were able to kind of see our loved ones a little bit more and open a few things up.
Okay, thank you. Apoorva Mandavilli is a science reporter at the New York Times, and Emily Martin is an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you, as always, for having me.
Thank you.
Less than 24 hours after a jury found former police officer Derek Chauvin guilty of murdering George Floyd, officers killed at least six people around the country. Yesterday, we talked about Makiya Bryant, who was fatally shot by police in Columbus, Ohio. And today, we shine a light on Elizabeth City, North Carolina. That's where 42-year-old Andrew Brown Jr. was shot and killed when deputies from the Pasquotank County Sheriff's Department opened fire last Wednesday morning. Details of what exactly happened are unclear, with the Sheriff's Department releasing very little information. Yesterday, the city was placed under a state of emergency in anticipation of the family being shown body camera footage of the shooting. We spoke to Andrew Carter, reporter at the News and Observer in Raleigh, on Tuesday morning. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start about what we know about the shooting and what happened.
Well, really, it's the story of what we don't know at this point. We know that the Pasquotank Sheriff's Department showed up at Andrew Brown Jr.'s house, attempted to serve him multiple warrants. One was an arrest warrant. One was a search warrant to search where he was living. And then there was, you know, obviously a shooting, and Brown wound up dead. We do not know how many shots were fired. We don't know the manner in which Brown was struck and hit by bullets. We don't know the reasoning behind the sheriff's deputy's use of such lethal force. And that's really been, you know, the central reason why there's been so much frustration within the community, is that this happened almost a week ago, 6 days ago now, and we still just do not have answers. And there is body camera footage the police has chosen not to release at this point. That part of it gets a little bit complicated due to different North Carolina laws sort of precluding how that footage is released. But unlike some of these other cases involving excessive use of force by police, such as George Floyd case, where we had raw video produced by a witness, we don't really have that dynamic here in this particular case. And so it's created just a lot of unknowns about what exactly took place.
And what was the Browns family able to see yesterday in the excerpt of the video?
The family saw 20 seconds, which their it's not very much. And their attorneys expressed some frustration about that yesterday during a press conference. One of the family attorneys basically said this was an execution, plain and simple. They claim that the video showed that Andrew Brown's hands were on the steering wheel. They claim that it showed that deputies basically tried to rush his vehicle where he was with guns out, guns drawn, and pretty much indicated that Brown more or less might have panicked and attempted to flee the scene. At the scene there, you can see still these tire tracks through this grassy lot where he attempted to drive through, and there was mud splattered on the side of his house, indicating that his tires were kicking up mud as he attempted to leave. And then basically he made it to across the street and he crashed into a tree in his neighbor's yard. And one witness that I spoke to last week claimed that after the first shot, she came outside and she saw the deputies, quote, just unloaded on him. And she claimed to have counted 14 shell casings out in the street. Could have been less than that. Maybe she miscounted. It could have been more. But again, there's just so many unknowns with this and we don't know. And even that 20-second clip that the family saw, it really created more questions than answers at this point and only served to inflame tension within the community.
And what are the challenges in North Carolina for accessing footage of officer-involved shootings? Why has it been so difficult for the family to see more than the 20-second excerpt?
Well, basically, the North Carolina General Assembly, Republican-led, decided in 2016 to make it a lot more difficult to obtain this kind of footage. You have to go through a lot of legal hoops and file different sort of petitions with judges and wait. And it's not as simple as just filing a public records request and obtaining it. Police video in North Carolina falls under the category of, I would describe it almost as a quasi-public record. There's all kinds of reasons as to why they can keep such video private. And one of the big challenges to this point so far is that the SBI, the State Bureau of Investigation, has launched an inquiry into this case. And so, you know, the Sheriff's Department in Pasquotank County has been, I don't want to accuse them of hiding behind it, but certainly they've used that as an excuse as to why they just can't put it out there. And so there's been a couple petitions on behalf of the city to a local judge to get this released. That was made last Friday. The town council had an emergency meeting to direct its city attorney to do that, to put that request in with the judge. I think a lot of folks thought that it might be released on Monday, and it just, you know, it still has not happened. And a lot of folks really within the community are very, very frustrated by that. They do not understand why it's taking upwards of a week now. We've been waiting for this footage to come out that I think would really answer a lot of questions, but it's not that simple here in this state, just because that's the law that's on the books nowadays.
Andrew Carter is a reporter at the News and Observer in Raleigh. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now we'll be speaking with City Councilman Darius Horton about what's happening in his community since this killing. Councilman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
So for those of us who aren't familiar, give us a brief description of Elizabeth City and what the community's like.
Well, we're a small knit community, just a little over 20,000 persons located right here near the Outer Banks. We pride ourselves in being a harbor of hospitality is our slogan. We're just a small knit community. Pretty much everyone knows everyone. A lot of mom and pop stores. Just a great place to live, a great retirement community. We do have three higher learning education facilities. We have the College of the Albemarle, and we have a Christian college, and also Elizabeth City State University. And we have a national Coast Guard base here. So it's a great place to live.
And now let's talk about Andrew Brown. Have you had a chance to view the body cam footage in this case? And if so, what were you able to see?
We have not had a chance to view the body camera in this incident. The local sheriff has deemed, along with the county attorney and the district attorney, that needs to only be released to the public. Which even though I'm an elected official, I would still fall in the category of public without, you know, it requires a court order. So the only persons that have seen it, of course, would be the law enforcement officials, the attorney, and yesterday his immediate family, very immediate, were able to see it along with some of the family's attorneys. And they were able to see a redacted 20-second clip.
Right. And now you're a member, of course, of the city council. The majority of the city council members and the mayor of Elizabeth City are African American. Have there been conversations in city government about the danger facing people of color at the hands of the police?
Oh, absolutely. And really, we began these conversations before this incident happened. We actually have an African-American police chief. And to piggyback on the first question that you asked me, of course, the way that we are governed here or policed here is, of course, inside the city limits, which I represent. We have a police department, and in the rural part, which we call the county, of course, the sheriff oversees that. This incident happened inside the city limits, which is the police's jurisdiction. However, it was a warrant that was being served by the county sheriff. So there was no police presence until after the incident transpired.
And what do you make of that? It sounds like that's a critical difference it was the sheriff's.
Yeah, it is problematic because out of courtesy, it's not needed. But normally, when a warrant is served inside the city limits, the police department is involved or at least notified. The sheriff does have jurisdiction over the entire county, so he doesn't have to. But normally, as a rule of thumb, that's how that would take place. But in this incident, it did not take place.
And has there been historically a different kind of relationship that folks in Elizabeth City have with the sheriff's department versus their own local police department?
Well, historically, we've always, you know, gotten along. I've been elected, I think, now close to 8-9 years. I've never heard of police brutality or anything like that on any major level. So this is kind of new for the city. I mean, it's kind of sad, in my opinion, as an elected official, how the county is handling this matter with no transparency. Yesterday, the family was given the time to come to view the video. And then they were said, no, you can't come. We need to redact the officers' names. We need to redact the officers' faces, their names off the badges. But from what the family told me when they went and viewed the video, Mr. Brown was not redacted. So, you know, it's just a very messy, slippery slope as it relates to this. And there were 8 body cameras and only one was showed, and it was showed for 20 seconds. And they're saying that they showed the pertinent part of the video. But, you know, do they have the right to determine what's pertinent and what's not pertinent, you know? So we're just in a very slippery slope now here in Elizabeth City.
Well, it sounds like you'd like to see more video, but any other next steps that you'd like to see about this?
Well, absolutely. We definitely would like to see, because see, right now as a small community, let me share this with you. I know if I want a nice pair of dress shoes, there's one or two places I can go and purchase them. So I'm not going to vandalize or try to tear down that business. But now, because of the national attention this situation has been given and the lack of transparency and accountability, you have persons coming here from all across the nation who come here with an intent that they believe that they have been, as a people, have been hurt. And there's an old saying I like to say that hurt people hurt people. And now out of frustration, you have people starting to want to get more violent, more, you know. So while I know that there's only two, you know, a couple of shoe stores, they don't know that. They'll tear the shoe store up and then go back to Georgia or New York or wherever they came from. And then I don't have anywhere to go buy no shoes. So I think it is very important that the county be as accountable as possible, as soon as possible, to kind of put a lid on this. Because the fact is, the facts are the facts. The video will not change. It is what it is. So put that out there to give the community some rest and to answer some unanswered questions.
Darius Horton is a city councilman for Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Councilman, thanks again so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This week, after months of delay, the Census Bureau released its state population totals, which are used to determine the number of seats each state will have in the House of Representatives for the next 10 years, and by extension, how many electoral college votes each state receives. The winners? Texas will gain 2 seats. Colorado, Florida, Montana, North Carolina, and Oregon gain 1 seat each. The states that lose a seat? Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and California, which lost a seat for the first time in its history. With me now to break down what we know so far from the 2020 census and what it means is Dave Wasserman, House Editor of the Cook Political Report. Dave, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with an overview of what these latest results and census data mean for the 2020 census and what kind of political ramifications it'll have.
Well, in demographic terms, it's a continuation of a long-term trend of power shifting from the Frost Belt and the North to the West and the Sun Belt. It was just a smaller shift than what we've typically seen in past decades. Politically speaking, if you had applied these electoral college totals to the 2020 election, Joe Biden would have won the race with 3 fewer electoral votes than he did, 303 versus 306. So this is a very slight boost for Republicans. But keep in mind that the bigger deal for control of the House in 2022 is going to be how the lines are drawn within these states, not just how many seats each state gets.
And that's something that we won't know until over the summer. That data won't come out to form those maps. Is that correct?
That's correct. We're expecting the detailed block level data needed to draw district lines in the fall. And of course, all of this data has been delayed, which puts states in a time crunch to get redistricting done, districts redrawn in time for the 2022 midterms. Now, keep in mind that Republicans have final authority over redistricting in states totaling 187 districts. That's down from 219 in 2011. Democrats only have final authority in states totaling 75 districts. That's up from 44 last time. But on balance, Republicans do have an advantage in this process. They only need 5 seats to reclaim control of the House, and they control some pretty big states.
So we were talking about the winners and losers. California is an interesting one, given that it's losing a seat for the first time in its history. What's going on there?
Los Angeles County accounts for California's decline in a House seat, most likely. We've seen, of course, a lot of Californians express concern about the cost of living in the past decade. But when you consider that California lost a seat and that Texas and Florida gained fewer seats than we expected, and Arizona didn't gain a seat at all, it also raises concerns as to whether Hispanics might have a lower count once we get the detailed data than the census estimates suggested in the past year. So that is a concern for advocacy groups, and it could be a detriment to areas with high non-citizen populations and to Democrats' prospects of maintaining their districts.
What other states did you find the data to be surprising, either for gaining or losing a seat?
Well, the biggest surprise to me was that Arizona, which has been growing pretty rapidly, did not gain a seat. But there were a number of states that breathed a sigh of relief. So Rhode Island, Alabama, and Minnesota were all on the cusp of losing districts, and they averted that. One of the shocking statistics was just how close the race was for the final seat in the U.S. House. Minnesota beat out New York State for the 435th seat in the House by just 26 people. In fact, if New York had 89 more residents in this count, then they would have kept their current number of House seats. And keep in mind that by April 1st, 2020, the census date, a lot of estimates or official totals suggested that there had been close to 2,000 COVID deaths in New York State. So it's possible that played a role.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, 89 votes is shocking and amazing, but the fact that this could actually be related to COVID is also stunning to me. Does reapportionment favor one party over another, or do we have to wait until redistricting is completed to know that?
Well, reapportionment itself is a small boost for Republicans because Texas and Florida are gaining seats, of course. But redistricting is really the bigger deal. And the big question is what a lot of these states with new bipartisan or independent commissions will do. For example, in Ohio, there's a new reform that requires some level of bipartisan consensus to pass maps. But it's also under the rules possible for Republicans in the legislature to overrule that commission and pass a 4-year map if there's a failure to achieve bipartisan compromise. Same thing is true on the opposite side in New York. So we're really waiting to see how some of these untested regimes and reforms play out before we know what the landscape will look like for 2022.
And of course, everything was delayed by the pandemic, but were there other factors that played a role in the delays?
Well, the census implemented a new data privacy measure called differential privacy, which was designed to prevent illicit actors from hacking or trying to assume the individual demographic characteristics of census respondents. And that is proven controversial. There are some Republicans who allege that that leads to a less than exact count of the population. And so these court battles may take some time to play out. But the main cause of this delay was the pandemic and the difficulty of getting a total count of the population.
Dave Wasserman is the House editor of the Cook Political Report. Thanks for breaking this all down for us, Dave.
Thanks very much, Nancy.
And we're going to round out the hour talking about something that's been keeping many of us company during the pandemic, podcasts. Even though fewer people have been commuting to work over the past year, a recent study from the media research company Edison Research found that both monthly and weekly podcast listenership has increased over the past year. For some of us, podcasts can be a complete escape, a chance to listen to your favorite comedians or athletes talk directly to you. And for others, like me, there's nothing more gripping than a well-reported true crime audio story.
What are you thinking is going to happen at the trial?
They would prove my innocence.
They prove your innocence?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At the end of this, they're going to say not guilty.
I was thinking, like, surely they will see through this, you know?
Yeah.
As you can see, that didn't work out.
Here to help us figure out what's worth checking out in this ever-growing landscape is Sarah Larson, a staff writer at The New Yorker who contributes to the column Podcast Department. Great to have you here, Sarah.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So as I said, I am, of course, a fan of true crime podcasts, but usually just the ones that are really well-reported and don't feel like they're exploiting the victims. So What makes a good true crime podcast, in your opinion?
Definitely sensitivity to the victims and the loved ones of the people the story is about. Responsible reporting, you know, made by people with more moxie than fact-checking, you know. A good new podcast, true crime podcast that's come out is Stolen, The Search for Jermaine. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, and we have a clip to play, so let's play that, and then you can tell us more about it.
She loved animals, hey?
Oh, yeah. Animals. She always wanted to have a little farm of her own. Quite the artist. Really very good artist, very good writer.
Tell us about Stolen.
Stolen is about the disappearance of Jermaine Charlo from a Missoula, Montana bar. She's from the Flathead Reservation, and the series is reported by Connie Walker, who's a journalist, who's a Cree woman, a Canadian First Nations. She did an excellent podcast a while ago called Missing and Murdered, Finding Cleo. And it's just, it's a beautifully reported and fascinating story about not just the disappearance of Jermaine, but of the community surrounding her. And it's really well done.
Some of the ones I've really liked are, we heard a clip at the very top from In the Dark. I'm listening to West Cork right now, and I like that one a lot. And I really loved Bear Brook.
Yes, those are some of my favorites. Yeah.
Yeah. And but what kind of problems do you see that arise in the genre of true crime?
Well, for one thing, many of them focus on, you know, middle-class white women, and sort of distort, you know, the perspective. A lot of them are presented mostly as entertainment. You know, there are a lot of podcasts that are beloved by many people that are sort of make true crime fun. And of course, you know, it's complicated. We listen to these partly because they're entertainment in some way, but it's also journalism and a riveting story. And, you know, it's important to get the tone right, and definitely not easy. So the ones that you mentioned, In the Dark is probably the best podcast ever made, in my opinion, but
it's right up there for sure.
Yeah. Even before it affected the Supreme Court. And yeah, It's a good one.
Impact and results are amazing from that one. So let's move away from true crime. You also have recommended Aria Code, which is produced by my colleagues at WNYC's classical station, WQXR. This one's about opera, and we have a sample of it. Let's play that.
So there's no history of Egypt conquering Ethiopia back in pharaonic times. This was a made-up story. However, it seeped in different power dynamics of Verdi's time in the 1880s. You've got the whole world of colonialism on the African continent. So we know that that was in the background.
Colonialism and opera. So do you need to understand opera to listen to this one?
No, not at all. And, you know, for me, I love music more than pretty much anything, and I'm not a musician. So anything that can help me understand the magic and the gorgeousness of music and how it happens is thrilling to me. And Aria Code to me does that really well. I mean, it's hosted by Rhiannon Giddens, and it brings in different experts in every episode to explicate a different aria. And then at the end, you hear the aria. And it's just, it's really lovely. It comes together really beautifully. And I always learn something, whether I know the aria or not. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah. You know, music, of course, is such a sort of obvious advantage in audio work and radio podcasting. But let's talk about Nocturne, because that's one that you recommend that deals with insomnia, which I would not say is a natural for radio. So let's play a quick clip of that one.
I think there's no animal more emblematic of the night than the owl. Of course, they're nocturnal, but that's not the only reason. They're also ephemeral and mysterious, keeping their distance from us in tree branches and on posts, showing only glimpses of themselves before vanishing in a silent flap of wings.
So is this one to listen to at night before bed, or definitely not?
No, it's beautiful. Nocturne is hosted by Vanessa Lowe, who produces it independently, and it's beautifully designed, and it's really about night. It's about stories that happen at night. A recent one was about a practice in the Netherlands called dropping, which involves leaving your kids in the woods at night and letting them find their way home. Not something I knew about, but they're all fascinating, and they're all very atmospheric and beautiful.
Podcasts have been on the rise, of course, for a while now. I love that there are now podcast critics like yourself. So when did you start on the beat? How did that happen?
It was a few years ago, before the advent of Serial and the explosion of podcasts that followed it. And I just feel lucky that I was able to, you know, sort of observe all of that as it was happening. It's just a form that I love. I love the combination of music and human intimacy and good storytelling. When done right, there's nothing like it.
I could not agree anymore. So you also recommend Cocaine and Rhinestones. Does the title say it all on that one?
The title says a lot, but the podcast says even more. It's a really unique and wonderful and funny and smart podcast about 20th century country music, hosted by Tyler Mahan Coe, who's the son of the country musician David Allen Coe. And he has a unique perspective on the history of country music and also the music itself. And he weaves together essays that he's written with, you know, clips of the music and stories. And he has a very fierce way of presenting information that is a little startling and quite wonderful, in my opinion. And so the first season came out in 2017, and that was about a bunch of different artists, the Leuven Brothers, Loretta Lynn, Ernest Tubb. The second season is about one person, George Jones, but it contains so many other stories within the story of George Jones. He's only released one episode so far. They're each about 2 hours long, and there will be 18 of them. So I've heard the first four episodes, and they're fantastic. And I'm very curious about where it will go next.
So the Slate podcast has Slow Burn, and it's just released its fifth season premiere. So this latest season looks at the Iraq War. What do you think of the first episode so far?
It's wonderful. It's got a really interesting character, Ahmed Shalabi, and who's, you know, unusual and fascinating. And the thing I love about Slow Burn, you know, which started a few seasons ago with the story of Watergate, right, is that it takes episodes from fairly recent history within some of our lifetimes. Others are less familiar with the topic at hand, but it just digs into what it was like to live through a particular experience, like the Clinton impeachment or Watergate or the Iraq War. And let's face it, who among us feels like they really know everything they should know about the Iraq War? Certainly, you know, not me. So I'm always really appreciative of Slow Burn and the way that it approaches its subjects. And this season is hosted by Noreen Malone, and so far it's a knockout. I mean, there's only one episode out, but I have a lot of faith that the rest will be just as good.
Sarah Larson is a staff writer at The New Yorker who contributes to the column Podcast Department. Thanks a lot, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Okay, folks, that's all we have for you today. We really appreciate you listening. Call us with your ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also record a voice memo on your phone and send it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Nancy Solomon, and this is The Takeaway.